Got a quick question about the process within the FMC, within the Open Committee. Do you all look at the same points of data, or does everyone bring in different points of data? How are you going around in the sessions in terms of interpreting the data, if you could comment on that?
So in terms of the macroeconomic data, I'm describing publicly available data. I would say we all look at the data. One of the roles of being a regional Fed president is to bring forward regional or local perspectives into the committee. So the way a committee meeting works is, to be more precise about it, is that there are 17 participants right now in a meeting. So there's 12 presidents and 5 governors. And each there is 2 rounds of speaking in turn. The first one is called the economics go-around, and we each provide a perspective on economic conditions. For the regional Fed presidents like myself, we're going to bring in information we've gathered from local contacts, both business and banking and more public contacts as well, to try to give a feel for what's happening in our local economies. But that's all for part of the process of information sharing. And then we'll also provide our perspectives on the national data. And certainly we're all, I would say, the numbers I just talked about are all publicly available and all shared among the committee members. And then at the second go-round, we all go around a second time to provide our perspectives on policy at that point in time. So that's how a meeting works.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. My name is Marilyn Kemmy. I want to ask you a question about the trade-offs of low interest rates. And let me just briefly give an example of what I'm talking about. And I'll read it just to be concise. Let's assume individuals hold about $10 trillion in taxable risk-free investments. And I'm talking about money market funds, bank CDs, and bank savings accounts. In 2007, that money earned 5% and generated about $500 billion in taxable income. That was real money with which people paid taxes, could save, or could spend. That amount of money, if spent, would have added about 3.3% to a $15 trillion economy, which can translate into a lot of jobs. Today, Fed interest rate policy means investment returns on those same risk-free investments is virtually zero. Let me add a simple demographic fact. There are 50 million people in this country collecting Social Security. The 75 million baby boomers are now aged 45 to 65. And that makes about 40% of the population today are savers. My question to you, and I think it supports your position, risk-free investment returns added $500 billion to the economy in 2007 and add virtually zero in 2011. And that's real money. Does anybody at the Fed discuss or measure this negative trade-off to savers, to taxes, or the economy of these low interest rates? Thank you.
Well, thanks for the detailed question. Certainly the distributional consequences of low interest rates are certainly something that receives consideration, I would say. I think that, let me offer a couple of perspectives on that. I think there's this temptation to think that the quote-unquote right interest rate in the economy would somehow be higher if it were not for Federal Reserve actions. What we've seen in the economy is with this loss of wealth associated with housing, a lot of people were, I'll speak for myself, I had a lot of equity in my home, I was planning on using that for my retirement. Now, if you lose that, you're going to try to save through other means. The same course of events, a related thing is that many people are very uncertain about the economic future. That's also putting pressure on savings. That is, many more people are trying to save than used to. This additional demand for savings is intrinsically a force that lowers interest rates. And I think one of the key puzzles and the key questions and key troubling features of the current situation is that we have corporations holding on huge amounts of cash. We have people who are, the demand for consumption has declined sharply. And all of that is in the face of very low interest rates. The point of trying to lower interest rates, as has been done, is to encourage people to consume. It's to encourage investment. And the issue is, why is it when tips yields are as low as they are that corporations are not finding projects that are worthwhile to invest in? So I'm trying to offer a perspective here of, yeah, interest rates have gone down, but I think it's a mistake to think that interest rates have gone down because of Fed policy. Instead, the Fed is trying to accommodate the forces within the economy by getting real interest rates to be as low as they should be.
Hi, thanks for being here today. I just want to hear what you have to say. I've been in economic class a long time ago. My hair was a lot browner when Dr. Vandeven was around. But every time you hear on a talk show Donald Trump, who is a big real estate tycoon and a pretty smart businessman and certainly knows money, says all the jobs are in Europe. And that might be true, and we have a global economy. How do we change the way of thinking that, you know, the jobs are in Korea or Asia or wherever? How do we get the big executives to restructure our companies to change the way of thinking in this country?
Well, that's a tough question for me. I mean, my area of focus, as I've tried to delineate here, is more on monetary policy. When I start to think about those kinds of questions, I try to think more about the long term as opposed to the short term. And I think the long term is, you know, the message for keeping the U.S. competitive is about keeping our citizens educated so they can be at the frontier in terms of skills. And, you know, I think that, you know, the University of Minnesota is part of that. All universities are part of that. On K-12 education is part of that. So this is something that, you know, keeping our citizens productive and competitive in the face of the kinds of changes in technology we're going to be seeing going down the road, I think that's essential. I don't think that over the last 20 years, I think there's certainly been evidence that did not do as well in that process as we did in the preceding 20 years. Human capital accumulation, as economists like to say, is still proceeding in this country, absolutely. But it's not proceeding as fast as in some other countries. And that kind of slippage is going to mean that our citizens will not be competitive and as we'd like them to be in a global context. So those kinds of questions that you just phrased, I try to think about them in a more, as I just indicated, a more longer-term perspective. And I think that pushes us towards thinking about education as being the engine of what's made this economy productive in the past and what it's going to need to make this economy productive in the future.
More and more thinking is that the monetary policy is pretty close to the end of the line and what it can do, and that more and more focus should be on fiscal policy along that line. What kind of FOMC rules and regulations would you try to communicate to the Congress on that, in terms of having more fiscal policy along that line, in terms of less regulation and other types of programs that they can put into place to try to give a more broad-based working capital environment?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot was built into a short question there. But I think that, you know, Chairman Bernanke spoke at Jackson Hole about fiscal policy. And I think, you know, clearly there are some tough challenges, some tough trade-offs we faced at a fiscal level in this country. When I think about here, I think about the 20 years of demographic changes, transitions we're going to be going through. We heard one questioner asked about, you know, the baby boomers are at 45 to 65. As those people become 65 to 85, and let me get it right, 75 to 95, because we have to think about that too, up to 75 to 95, that's going to put additional stress on our demographic structure and on the structure of taxes and transfers we've set up. What the chairman spoke about in Jackson Hole is having a process for meeting those trade-offs in a way that's less disruptive economically than the process that we went through at the end of July and early August. I think that would be enormously helpful for the economy, that we're going to face these trade-offs. There's no way to get around them, and different people are going to disagree about how to resolve those trade-offs. And I, you know, as an economist, I can point to trade-offs. You know, the choices have to be made by the citizens at the end of the day. But it'd be better to have a process that involves a resolution of those trade-offs that does not involve the introduction of short-term financial market uncertainty to the extent that we saw in late July and early August. Well, I've cleared up everything. That's great.
I'd be curious about your perspective on the deflationary challenges associated with the massive deleveraging in developed markets, particularly, obviously, in the States and in light of the European austerity experiment.
Well, I think this is something that has been of great concern to the Federal Reserve over the last 3.5 years, and it continues to be, you know, I think a concern going forward is that there are strong disinflationary pressures it's for some assets deflationary pressures that are in the economy. That's why the Federal Reserve has taken as accommodative a stance as it has, is in order to keep inflation at as high as it is, at 2%, it's a declared objective. I think those challenges will remain. Right now, I think we're doing very well on that from that perspective. I think that the rate of price growth in the country has been 2% over the past 3.5 years. I expect it to be about 2% going forward. But it's something I think we have to be cautious about and careful about, in as I indicated, I dissented at the last FOMC meeting. But one of the things I'm looking for to see whether or not we need more monetary accommodation is exactly what's going to be happening to prices. It's be watching the data on prices unfold to see if we see a renewal of the disinflationary pressures we saw in 2010.
One of the things I was wondering about is the CPI. You mentioned your calculation does not include energy or food. And for most people, when you go to the grocery store or fill your gas, those seem to be going much higher than 2%. And what do your models show has been the inflation with those factors? And should we be considering that model since it impacts most people in this room?
So that's a great question. So it gives me an opportunity to clarify something I wasn't clear enough about in my remarks. So when I talked about inflation over the past 3.5 years being at 1.8%, that was a measure of inflation that included food and energy. Okay. Now, when I talked about measures of inflationary pressures in the economy, it's true I stripped food and energy away. That's over the last 6 months. And it's because, I'll take oil as an example. Oil went up very sharply at the beginning of the year. We didn't expect it to keep going up at 20% per year for the next 5 years. We expected it to flatten out or maybe even come down. Once it flattens out, it's no longer putting pressure on inflation anymore. And so I keep track of core as a measure of where I think inflation is going to be going, just because I don't want to have these ups and downs in the oil price contaminate the data too much. But most of the things I remarked upon, I'll go back over the things I talked about in terms of inflation. Inflation over the past 3.5 years has been 1.8%. That measure includes food and energy. The expectations of inflation over the next 5 years, that includes food and energy. The upward tick, the low level of inflation last year, of less than 1%, that number was about 1% for all inflation, including both food and energy as well. It was near historical lows in November 2010. It's come up in the first part of the year more rapidly than core itself. So I don't think if you used headline, it would, in any place where I used core, it would change any of my messages. I just wanted to be clear about what measure I was using at what time. I think we're on the last question, so pressure's on.
So you said that you downgraded your economic growth estimate this year from 3.1% to 2.2% or something along those lines. There's a lot of drum beating right now that we're heading into another economic recession. So what you said doesn't take that viewpoint. Why?
Yeah, I still see sufficient sources of strength in the economy. I think that I'll be the first to say that the low rate of economic growth in the first half of this year, less than 1% annualized, was a big surprise to me. And it led me to downrate my forecast going forward. But I do think that a number of the reasons why we had low economic growth in the first part of the year were temporary reasons. I think that the The rapid increase in energy prices certainly cut into consumer spending. I think that the global supply chain, effect on global supply chains from the events in Japan was just much stronger than certainly I expect or anyone would have anticipated. So I actually think coming back from that will give us a little bit of an impetus in growth in the second half of the year and into 2012. I think the bigger issue is, so my expectation is we will not have a recession. But I really think that this focus on what's going to happen in the next 6 months or a year is maybe not the place where we should be placing our emphasis so much from the point of view of economic policymaking for the country as a whole. The issue really is that the U.S. normally grows around 2.5% per year, or 2.5% to 3% per year. We had a recession of 5%. To make up for that lost output, to generate the job growth we need to get people back to work at the same rate that they were employed at the beginning of the recession, we need to have growth much faster than 2.5% to 3% a year. So this focus on whether or not we're going to be at 2.5 or 1 or slightly under 0, that's, you know, obviously it matters. But the bigger question is, why have we had such low growth over the past 3.5 years, and even over the past 2 years since the end of the recession? There's a great book by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff called This Time is Different, which is the history of the past 8 centuries of financial crises. This Time is Different is sarcastic. It's not different. And the point is that one of the lessons from that book by Reinhart and Rogoff is that recoveries after financial crises tend to be very slow. Employment seems to be suppressed for long periods of time. Output is suppressed for long periods of time. The question that policymakers and academics are asking is that mean that there's no policy response that can get us back fast? Or does that mean that that policy response has not yet been found? And that's the question. And I don't have an answer to that, but that is the question we have to ask. Thank you very much for your attention.